Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and it's my pleasure and privilege to present once again Wesley J. Smith, the author of Forced Exit, subtitled A Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published by Times Books and copyright 1997. Wesley, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thank you very much.
Now, before the break, we were talking about some of the revisions in theory and practice of medicine, which will allow us to proceed down the slippery slope, and we were talking about the historical precedent of Germany. You were talking about the Binding and Hoch book. The title of which was, again?
Permission to Destroy Life Unworthy of Life.
And we were talking about the Naur case, once again, which was?
Which was a child who was born with birth defects, and the parents asked Chancellor Hitler to have permission to have the baby killed, which he granted, and that was when he decided that this was the time to allow doctors, again, not force them. No doctor in Germany was forced to kill anybody, but allow doctors who wish to participate to kill disabled infants, and then that spread to the T4 program, which was the killing of disabled and mentally retarded adults.
And by the way, some of the, as we have discussed before on this program, some of the technicians, most of the technicians who ultimately staffed the killing centers such as Auschwitz and Treblinka, got their training in the euthanasia center.
Yes, the T4 program kind of became the test run. But you know, it's very interesting. The T4 program was officially canceled by Hitler because of pressure from the people, which is pretty amazing when you consider that you were dealing with the mother of all death cultures.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there was a Catholic cardinal who spoke in the pulpit against this euthanasia program, and people demonstrated. They were all saying the Führer must not know. But Goering ended up calling it, Himmler ended up calling it a secret that is not a secret. And the T4 program was rescinded, although the killing of infants was not rescinded. But even though Hitler rescinded the T4 program, it continued because doctors were doing it because they thought it was the best thing to do. And that's what, you know, we're really in danger here in this country. I've been reading for my new book on bioethics some articles in the British Medical Journal about how doctors are again being told that their primary duty is not to their individual patient, but to, quote, the community or, quote, the HMO, and they're being told that their ethics to the individual patient, the Hippocratic tradition, has become passé. Now, I'm not saying that will lead to the T4-type program and death camps, but there are other ethical ways to fall off a cliff.
And this is a redefinition of theory and practice of medicine, not dissimilar to the one which took place in Germany and which set the stage for
What set the stage for the horrors of German medicine was the belief that all life did not have equal inherent moral worth, that there were some of us who were unworthy of life. Another term used in Germany was useless eaters.
Mm-hmm.
And now in our current parlance, we are saying that some of us are not persons.
You talk about an organization called CCMD, which is redefining medical ethics in a fashion not dissimilar to that in Germany.
That's the Colorado Collective for Medical Decisions, which is trying to promote what's something called futile care, F-U-T-I-L-E, that says that when doctors find that they believe the quality of life isn't worth living, they can refuse desired medical treatment. So I've done a lot more research into this whole idea of futile medical treatment since Forced Exit, and it's much worse than my book presents, than Forced Exit presents. I just scratched the surface in Forced Exit, and we'll be dealing it in a much deeper level in the new book on bioethics, but that won't be out for about a year and a half. Although I do a lot of writing in journals and in newspapers about these issues also.
You cite a case called the Nguyen case. Am I pronouncing that right? N-G-U-Y-E-N? Ryan Nguyen?
Maybe Ryan.
Yes, which, although it had a happier ending than the Naur case, is sort of similar.
Well, yeah, here's what's happening. Here's what feudal care theory is about. And a lot of people, let me set the stage here. A lot of people promote and support assisted suicide because they're running on a great deal of fear. And the fear is based on the idea of being hooked up to machines against your will. And that used to happen quite a bit. And I would point out to the audience that one of the reasons that happened quite a bit was because it paid a lot of money. That in those days, we used to have what it was called fee-for-service medicine. That is, for every service provided by a hospital or by a physician, they would get paid a fee. And the more they did then, the more profitable it was for them. So a lot of people found that it was very hard to get their doctors to stop when they'd had enough. And that led to laws such as permitting advanced directives for medical decision-making, generically known as living wills. But you know, Dave and the audience, the finances of healthcare have now shifted. They have shifted to HMOs, managed care, and profits are now made, huge profits, from controlling and cutting costs. So the idea of having to be hooked up to a machine against your will, while not completely over, is fading very quickly. The new danger is not being given the treatment you want because the doctors or the health insurance executive don't think your life is worth living. That's the basis of feudal care theory, sometimes called inappropriate care.
And we should also remember that the reorientation of the doctor's responsibility to the state rather than to the patient is another factor in this context, as well as profit.
That's right, but not just the state, to the HMO.
Right, correct.
To the corporation.
Absolutely.
Which is truly dangerous because the corporation's agenda is to make money.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't to promote the general welfare, which is supposedly the state's purpose. So we have now a great deal of literature on feudal care theory that this is not just a future scare, it's here and now.
Yeah.
You have the thoracic surgeons, you have the critical care physicians saying, passing ethical opinions for their society, saying that doctors can, based on their own ethics, stop with any treatment they believe is inappropriate. And you now have hospitals trying to create these inappropriate care protocols that they hope will be honored by judges. And that, if you have the time, I'll go through the kind of history of this. It started approximately 10 years ago with a case called Wangley, W-A-N-G-L-I-E. There was a doctor, there was a woman who was had a stroke and was diagnosed in a persistent vegetative state. Her husband wanted her tube feeding to continue and her respirator. One of the doctors said this is wrong. Now remember when we talked earlier about the food and fluids cases, how this is supposedly about choice.
And about compassion.
And that's right, and compassion, that if a person or their surrogate's value system says we want to stop medical treatment of food and fluids, we should be allowed to do that based on patient autonomy. Well, in the Wangley case, the patient autonomy was to continue the treatment. Mrs. Wangley was a Jehovah's Witness, and she had told her husband she wanted to have continued medical treatment if she got sick. Her husband was her caregiver, husband of 54 years. And the doctor, one of the ethicists, actually, who was involved in this case, brought a lawsuit against the husband because he refused to terminate her medical treatment so that she would die. He lost that lawsuit in 1990, but then very shortly thereafter, the next year, a case in which parents were turned in Michigan to the child abuse authorities for child abuse lost their right to make the medical decisions for their baby who had been born premature. And Dave, do you know what the child abuse was?
No.
The child abuse was to continue medical treatment.
Whoa.
This was a child who was most certainly going to die, but had gained a pound, had fought off a bacterial infection. The doctor said that this is futile care. The parents, young parents, Medicaid case, of course, said, I want treatment to continue. They were turned in for child abuse, brought before the dependency court, and their rights to decide for their own baby stripped from them because, and only because, they refused to cease medical treatment of their child who was dying but not brain dead or anything of the kind. The child died before the appeal, but that led to the Baby Ryan case, which you introduced. Baby Ryan was up in Spokane, Washington, born of a Vietnamese immigrant and his wife, again, another Medicaid case.
And wasn't she also a Native American?
I'm not sure. She might have been. I don't recall that.
I believe she was. Go ahead.
And they claim that there was malpractice, Baby Ryan's parents, in the delivery. I don't know whether that's true. That's currently the subject of a lawsuit. But what is indisputable is that the following happened. The child was born at 23 weeks gestation. The doctors put the child on life support, including kidney dialysis, found out he was not a suitable recipient for a kidney transplant, and then told the parents, quote, it is time for your child to die, and took the child off kidney dialysis over the specific objections of both parents.
Mm-hmm.
Baby Ryan would have died, except the parents went to a lawyer and got an injunction. And the injunction said, you must continue treatment until we can sort this thing out. It was a temporary restraining order, which was basically to maintain the status quo, which was treatment. The doctors then, because they got the injunction, turned the parents into the child abuse authorities for getting the injunction. That didn't work. They then fought in court saying that there was, quote, no chance, close quote, of this child surviving, and that it violated their ethics, their values, and their morality to continue treatment.
Mm-hmm.
The decision was never made in court because another doctor took over the care of baby Ryan, and the child was transferred to a hospital in Portland, Oregon. Well, guess what? The child survived. The child was weaned off dialysis and today is a four-year-old boy with some health problems, but is alive and growing. And had the doctors been able to impose their values in this case, that child would be dead. Now, you talk to people who support feudal care, and they say, as I quoted in Forced Exit with Dr. Murphy, who's with the Colorado Collective for Medical Decisions, baby Ryans are the price that we're going to have to pay to have a more just medical system. That is, we're going to, in order to expand coverage of people, we have to sacrifice the weak and the vulnerable. But Dave, this is no different than exposing infants on hills, as used to happen in ancient times if a child was born with disabilities, or leaving the old and infirm by the side of the trail.
And,
it's immoral, and it's unethical, and it is not about choice. It is about, indeed, creating a duty to die. And when I say the terms duty to die, I say that because there are now very serious discussions in the academic level and in bioethics literature about the fact, in their view, that there is a duty to die.
Many people would like to calm their own fears about this, and indeed there's a lot of impetus in that direction, by saying, well, there are guidelines, and you cite numerous examples of those guidelines dissolving very quickly, the Netherlands being among them.
Well, all right, yeah, we hear that guidelines will protect against abuse, and we hear that in assisted suicide, and we hear that in the idea of cutting off life support. Well, the guidelines don't protect anything. They just provide a veneer of the appearance of control so people will not be afraid. But let's take a look at what's happened in the Netherlands since euthanasia and assisted suicide became part of routine medical practice. In 1973, permission was given by a judge for euthanasia. And the idea was it is acceptable if the guidelines are followed. That has since been placed into legislation. It's not technically legal. It's technically illegal. But if the doctors in the Netherlands follow the guidelines, they will not be prosecuted. The guidelines include things such as, in fact, they're stricter than the guidelines in Oregon, which we can talk about if you want. But they include a second opinion, a repeated and consistent request by the patient to be killed. Euthanasia is only acceptable if nothing other than euthanasia is available to alleviate suffering. Well, it's just not even followed. And here's what's happened in the Netherlands since 1973. Doctors have gone from killing terminally ill patients who want to be killed, to killing chronically ill patients who want to be killed, to killing people who are depressed without a physical illness.
Anorexic.
A woman with anorexia because she was afraid she'd start binging and purging again. The depressed person was a woman whose children had died. This is a case of Chabot, C-H-A-B-O-T, in the Dutch Supreme Court. A woman had children had died over several years. She became obsessed with being buried between them. She bought a cemetery plot, moved the children to the cemetery plot, leaving her grave open in between them, and then got a psychiatrist, Chabot, to assist her suicide, even though he'd only seen her for four times and had not tried to treat her depression. The Dutch Supreme Court said, well, sure, that's fine, because suffering is suffering. It doesn't have to be physical. It can be mental. So we now have depressed patients in the Netherlands able to be killed by doctors, and then they move to people who cannot, by definition, consent, babies. Babies are killed in the Netherlands just like baby Knauer was in Germany for the very same reason, based on a livable life, by Dutch pediatricians and gynecologist obstetricians. At least 15 to 20 babies are killed a year in the Netherlands based on their, quote, not having a livable life. The Lancet, which is a British medical journal, says that 8% of all infants who die are killed by doctors. Babies, by definition, can't consent to being killed. So the guidelines mean nothing.
Bearing in mind, they mean zero.
And then what happens is about 6,000 patients are killed a year who have not asked to be killed, 1,000 by the overdose of curare, which is how euthanasia is practiced in the Netherlands, and another 5,000 by an intentional overdose of morphine or other narcotic not intended to alleviate pain, but designed with the specific intent of killing the patient.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 6,000 people a year killed who have not asked to be killed in the Netherlands.
And bear in mind, in this country, baby Ryan, the doctors treating baby Ryan wanted to kill him, and he's now fine. He's a happy, healthy.
They wanted to cut him off from life support over the parents' objections based on their value system. I interviewed Governor Lamb the other day for my new book. Because there's not enough money to be saved, by the way, in stopping end-of-life care to give everybody health insurance. I mean,
mm-hmm.
that's the excuse for this. But people think that end-of-life care takes up, you know, most of the health care budget. It's not true. 10% of the entire health care budget is end-of-life care. That's all. So unless we decide as soon as somebody gets a terminal diagnosis, which again is often mistaken, that we're going to kill them immediately, we're not going to save that much money. And so, but this whole idea of feudal care is designed to create the precedent that doctors can decide to say no based on values other than those of the patient. That is based on HMO values or based on this concept that they speak about in bioethics literature of, quote, distributive justice, close quote. And it is designed to bring us to a very rigid type of healthcare rationing.
In the little over 10 minutes that are left to us, Wesley, I'd like to talk about, in connection with the entire issue of depression, some of the fuzzy definitions which are leading us down that slippery slope, including, quote, hopeless illness, unquote.
Yes, a hopeless illness. I've got to go step back again. There's something now in psychiatric literature called rational suicide. And psychiatric literature is basically saying that if a suicide is, quote, irrational, suicide prevention should be engaged in. But if suicide is rational, close quote, then the psychiatrist's job is not to try to help save the life of the patient, but in essence to see whether or not there can be a facilitation of the suicide. I mean, this is a profound abandonment by the most desperate people in our culture, by the very physicians who are supposed to help treat the patient who is terribly depressed. And a hopeless illness, people will think, let me step back again, I'm sorry, there's so many ideas in my head. Proponents of assisted suicide abuse the language. They used to say we want it for, you know, assisted suicide or euthanasia for people who are terminally ill, which is often defined as somebody who's going to die within 6 months. But then now they're starting to use words like incurable illness. Now, the term incurable illness is meant to convey the idea of terminal illness, but it isn't. Somebody with arthritis has an incurable illness. Somebody with diabetes has an incurable illness. Somebody who is asymptomatic HIV positive has an incurable illness. Somebody who is schizophrenic probably has an incurable illness. So you can see how this very quickly slides.
Mm-hmm.
The concept of hopeless illness is as follows, and I've got a definition that I took from the psychiatric literature, and I'll read it very slowly. Terminal illnesses, maladies causing severe physical and or psychological pain, physically or mentally debilitating and or deteriorating conditions, and circumstances where the quality of life is no longer acceptable to the individual.
We might want to mention, too, that with regard to the German T4 program, that psychiatric patients were among those who were disposed of.
Absolutely. And what we're saying with this idea of hopeless illness is that it's basically death on demand for anybody with a sustained suicidal desire, because anybody who wants to commit suicide believes that the quality of their life is no longer acceptable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not confined to illness. As in the Netherlands with this woman whose children had died. Another documented case in the Netherlands is a woman who had horrible memories of the Holocaust. The answer was for her doctor to euthanize her. Now, the irony of that and the tragedy of that is beyond belief.
Mm-hmm.
The ballet dancer who was euthanized because she couldn't dance anymore. The person who had scars from skin cancer on her face who couldn't stand to look in the mirror. The woman with the anorexia fear. A man who was HIV asymptomatic, who was afraid of future suffering, the answer to that is to be killed by the doctor. What happened to living with AIDS? What happened to psychiatric help? What happened to assuring the person through hospice and so forth that nobody will ever abandon that person and everything that can be done will be done to alleviate suffering? Well, guess what? In the Netherlands, because they have euthanasia, in my opinion, they don't have a hospice movement.
And by the way, near the end of the interview, and we're getting pretty close to that now, we want to touch on not only the hospice movement, but palliative care, and in the case of the disabled, who are among those groups who you identify as being oppressed by euthanasia, when you talk about euthanasia as a form of social oppression, the independent living movement. But you talk in terms of paving the slippery slope about, and I've used the term Orwellian to describe so many aspects, and the language really is such as the use of the term hopeless illness or incurable illness.
That's right, and it goes beyond that. It's not assisted suicide, it's gentle landing, it's self-deliverance. Now they're talking about assisted dying. Hospice is assisted dying. I'm a hospice volunteer, and I've seen what hospice does. That is, people are not hooked up to tubes, they're not in hospitals, they're in home, and people are there for them as they go through the dying process. That's assisted dying. That's about living. Hospice tells, the message of hospice is that every life is valuable. When people have cancer and they're down to 90 pounds, they're valuable and they're precious. The message of assisted suicide and euthanasia is you are undignified, your life is unworth living, the only answer and best answer for you is to be killed. And that's a terrible, profound pain to people who are going through these experiences. I've talked to one of my hospice patients who speaking tonight of Kevorkian killing an ALS patient, my last patient had ALS. I was with him for 20 months. I spent hours and hours and hours with this man. And every time people would say on television that they thought somebody with ALS should be allowed to have assisted suicide, he took it personally. He thought, they're trying to force me out, and these were his words, they're trying to force me out of the lit boulevards into the dark alleys because they don't want to see me.
Yep. A similar type of cultural, I don't know if snobbery would be the way to put it, or revulsion or denial, perhaps a little of all of those, applies to the whole concept of disabled people and the difference between the way disabled people see themselves and the way medical professionals often see them is central here.
Absolutely. There are all kinds of studies where disabled people, people who are quadriplegic, people who can't move, their assessment, their mental assessment 5 years into the injury is about the same as the non-disabled community. 1 year into the injury, they're very depressed. 5 years after they've gone through the very difficult, and no one's saying it's easy, adjustment period, then you find that most quadriplegics, not all, but most, have come to the same place where most, the average person is, where some are depressed and many are not, right? But the attitude of their caregivers and physicians towards their lives are completely different. They see these people as having less valuable lives than the people themselves see themselves as having. Now, there's an answer. A lot of times people who are quadriplegic want to commit suicide or have their food and fluids terminated or their respirators turned off because they're being housed in nursing homes. They don't have to be in nursing homes. There's something called the independent living movement that gets people, even quadriplegics, into their own apartments. One of my good friends is Mark O'Brien. People may remember 2 years ago there was a Oscar-winning documentary about his life. He's lived in an iron lung as a complete quadriplegic since he was age 6. He has graduated from UC Berkeley with a degree in English and journalism. He is a journalist. He is a published poet. There have been 2 Mark O'Brien days in Berkeley. He is anti-assisted suicide, anti-euthanasia, pro-independent living. And he says that the whole assisted suicide movement is because people don't want to think about disabled people. They want them out of their faces. He and, in fact, most of the organized disability rights movement opposes assisted suicide because they don't see themselves as the beneficiaries of this, which is being promoted at, they are being promoted as, but as the targets. They're in the crosshairs.
And Mark O'Brien is what's called a high quad, and that is one of the groups that has been targeted the most by the Kevorkians and those of similar.
Absolutely, and those are people whose organs are being looked at as a natural resource now.
With regard to pain, a lot of people are also afraid of lingering on in terrible agony, but you point out that palliative care can solve even the most extreme of those problems.
A lot of people are very concerned about dying in agony, and I'm here to tell you today that that does happen in this country.
Sure.
But it doesn't happen because it has to happen. It happens because untrained or insensitive doctors and ignorant patients and family members, and I don't mean that as in a bad sense, but they just don't know, allow it to happen. According to the American Cancer Society, 95% of all cancer pain can be utterly eliminated, and the other 5% can be substantially alleviated. Yet 50% of cancer patients receive inadequate pain control. That's a national scandal. Only 8% of AIDS patients in serious agony and pain receive strong narcotics to alleviate their pain. That is a national scandal. But what assisted suicide is saying is that the answer to that malpractice, because that's what it is for the very doctor who treated you so poorly that it led to a desire for you to kill yourself, to be able to kill you as an answer to the malpractice that caused you to have the suicide desire in the first place. I don't know about you, Dave, but to me that's absolutely nuts. The answer to the scandal of untreated and undertreated pain is better pain control, better medical care, and laws that get the government off doctors' backs that try to do that job.
One of the points that you make in the book is that minority groups, too, have traditionally not received the medical care. They've been discriminated against with regard to medical care as well.
Absolutely.
And in our last couple of minutes, we might also want to touch ever so briefly, and I don't want to overload the plate here, but on eugenics, one of the factors upon the German euthanasia movement, and something which still is very much with us in the United States, and it's not a new phenomenon.
Well, in terms of people who oppose assisted suicide, there was recently an election in Michigan, and the media didn't cover it. It's astonishing. Michigan voters had a chance to legalize assisted suicide. They said no, not by 51%, not by 58%, but by 71%. 71 to 29%, they said no. This is the state of Kevorkian. They see what this leads to.
Mm-hmm.
The people who opposed it the strongest were the elderly, again, the supposed beneficiaries, and African Americans. Now, African Americans understand what oppression is. And African Americans understand that their health care is often given the last, they're often last in the line for good health care. But they also understand that in many ways they'd be the first in line for assisted suicide. Now let me tell you what's happening in Oregon in, with regard to that.
We've got just over a minute and a half left.
Well, all right. Oregon has passed an assisted suicide law and immediately said that Medicaid would cover it. So poor people can be killed in Oregon, and what makes that so, and paid for by the state, and what makes that so reprehensible is that Oregon, in its Medicaid program, rations health care so that many cancer patients, low birth weight babies, and others can't get medical treatment. But if that leads them to despair to want to kill themselves, they can get assisted suicide. The farm workers supporters in Oregon, for example, the people who support the people who go up and pick the crops, call that death squad medicine. And that's exactly what it is. And that's exactly what assisted suicide and euthanasia is. It is death squad medicine. It is not compassion. It is not choice. It is abandonment. And it is saying to the most weak and vulnerable among us, you're no longer us. You are them. We don't care if you live or die. And that is a horrible message for any compassionate and loving society to send to anybody.
Right. Bear in mind that budget cutting is very much the order of the day, and people might be part of those budget cuts. We've been speaking with Wesley Smith, the author of Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder, published by Times Books, copyright 1997. Wesley, we will be visiting with you again in the future. Thanks so much for visiting with us.
Thank you, and thanks to your audience for listening.
For Wesley Smith, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.